Good morning, everybody. It is September 8th, 2021. This is your home away from homeroom, your ADK homeroom. I am your teacher in exile, Frank, and I am happy to be here today commenting on the news with you for about 20 to 30 minutes and then continuing our deep dive from yesterday into that which is unseen, in the sense that Basquiat, of course, in his seminal 1850 essay. So let's start things off, as we always do, with the science fact of the day. I went down, down, down into the ring of fact. So there you have it. And today's science fact of the day is about Oklo in Gabon. Gabon in West Africa, and Oklo being the particular region there. This is the only place in the world known to have had what? There is one site only in the world that had this happen there, and it was Oklo in Gabon. You might know, because there is a new startup that's getting a lot of press, and they've named themselves Oklo. Yes! Well, hopefully you got it. This is the site of the world's only known natural nuclear reactor. That's right, there was such a thing. There was a natural nuclear reactor here in Oklo. It was about 2 billion years ago, maybe 1.8, 1.7 billion years ago. And it wasn't just one, actually. There were 16 of these reactors scattered across the site there. It ran for about 100,000 years also. The power generated less than 100 kilowatts, maybe around 100 kilowatts on average over the duration of the reactor's timeline. How much power is that? Well, one way to think about it is, if you have a 100-watt bulb, if you have, maybe you're smuggling in some old incandescent bulbs, some illegal, some contraband here in the United States after our federal Congress banned such naughty, naughty things. You wicked person, you, if you have a 100-watt incandescent bulb. Well, so if you're running a 100-watt incandescent bulb, 100 kilowatts would be 1,000 of those, enough power to run 1,000 of those. Another way to think about it, a microwave is around a kilowatt in power, and so that would be 100 microwaves, enough power to run 100 microwaves. That's obviously not going to run the city of Schenectady or anything like that, but it is enough to run a few microwaves, cook yourself some frozen chicken tikka masala. Delicious. Now, why did this happen? How could this happen? Many people think that a nuclear reactor, right, is the height of technology and requires extreme precision and skill in engineering. And having a natural nuclear reactor would be like having a natural F-15 Strike Eagle. That would be certainly unusual. So how could we have a natural nuclear reactor? Well, it turns out that having a nuclear reactor, this is a fission reactor, of course, where you're splitting the atom apart to release energy. That's nothing compared to having a F-15 Strike Eagle. Now, it's still very hard to do it under controlled circumstances, but the situation here was just right. The geology, the chemistry was just perfect for it to happen. Key to the ability of this reactor to exist is the fact that 2 billion years ago, your enriched uranium, that is uranium-235, with a total of 235 protons and neutrons in its nucleus. Enriched uranium still accounted for about 3% of the uranium in existence on Earth's surface in uranium ore. So that's actually about the same percentage that they use in fission reactors these days. And it was enough to start a nuclear chain reaction. And then fissioning these nuclei in the uranium. And then instead of heating up to absurd temperatures and just destroying the site, melting, destroying the site, there happened to be just enough water. And the groundwater acted as the moderator. And not only was there just enough water there, but there was a steady supply of just enough water, and it trickled in at just the right rate so that the water would come in it would cool down the reaction, the whole thing would stop, and then the water would boil off, and then after cooling down this way, then the whole thing would start up again. It had a cycle time of about 3 hours, apparently. And this went on for 100,000 years. The chain reaction would start, I would go, I would get hot, a couple hundred degrees Celsius, then the water would trickle in, it would moderate it, suck off the heat, the water would boil off, the material would cool down, and then it would continue again. I've always found that fascinating, that there was a natural nuclear reactor. We've never found another site anywhere on the planet that had a natural nuclear reactor going. So these 16 different reactors in this one site in Oklo, pretty rare as far as we know. Could it ever happen again? No, it actually could not happen now because all of the uranium has decayed. The half-life of U-235 is much shorter than the half-life of U-238. So even though we have a ton of U-238 around, there's not a high enough natural abundance. I think the natural abundance of U-235 is down now to about 0.5, 0.8%, somewhere in there. And it's just not enough to start something like this again. So it won't be happening. You can forget about those dreams if you had them of walking out in your backyard and finding a natural nuclear reactor going one morning. That would be kind of cool, but it's not going to happen. Let's move into our news. Yesterday, I promised that we would talk about the Steven Pinker versus Martin Rees long bet. So let's do exactly that. Steven Pinker and Martin Rees are kind of the odd couple. They represent maybe the pessimistic side in the case of Rees. He's an astronomer from Great Britain, and Pinker, cognitive psychologist from Harvard, and Pinker's the optimist. So they had a bet in 2017. The time span was 2017 to 2020, and their bet was that Rees said that a bio error or bioterror event would kill 1 million people by 2020. A single event. Had to be a single event. And it looked like Steven Pinker was going to win, right? Everything was cruising from 2017 through 2020. And then COVID. Yes, that's right. COVID happened, and obviously it has killed more than 1 million people, so it would satisfy the bet if it is proven to be a lab, if it is proven to have a lab origin. So Rees could win this bet, but Pinker could win the bet too, right? If it has a natural origin, if the SARS-CoV-2 virus has a natural origin, then Steven Pinker will come out on top, and if it doesn't, if it's a lab leak, or heaven forbid, actually a lab-engineered virus, then Rees would come out on top and win the bet. There's a recent article in Science Magazine about this and about how we might settle it. It's obviously a very important question. I do have to point out one thing, though. In unheard.com, love unheard.com, they call Martin Rees an apocalyptic scientist, and they mean that that he's pessimistic and he's always talking about the end of the world. I just have to point out, technically, etymologically, apocalypse refers to a revelation, right? And it just so happens that the revelation and the book of Revelations, what was revealed was the end of the world. So the word apocalypse, the word revelation, has come to sort of be conflated with that meaning of the end of the world, doomsday. Anyway, so who is going to win this bet, Pinker the optimist or Rees the pessimist? We don't know. Let's look at the origins of the virus, though. See what we can figure out from this science article. Well, the first thing to note about this science article is that it quotes Christian Anderson, and that immediately, to me, raises doubts about maybe not doubts, but certainly a couple of questions about the veracity or the credibility, I should say, of the article, the credibility of the article, because Christian Anderson, right, he was one of the virologists who spearheaded the early collusion, intending to downplay, and it did downplay, the possibilities of a lab origin. He said at the very beginning, in the spring of 2020, that there was no way it could have a lab origin. It had to be zoonotic, had to come from animals, and so we shouldn't even look at it. And as a result of that, as a result of this guy steering everybody in this direction, we lost extremely valuable time. We lost extremely valuable evidence, probably, or at least the chance to gather evidence at that early key stage of the pandemic. We're never going to get that time back. So that was very poorly done by Anderson, regardless of whether or not the virus turns out to have a zoonotic origin, or whether it was a lab leak, a lab accident, whether it was engineered in the lab. Regardless of any of that, Anderson did science and the world, really, a huge disservice by jumping the gun and publishing that article and pretending to knowledge that he did not have. So when I see this article in Science Magazine quoting him and relying on him for expert advice, he is obviously an expert, and we definitely do not know yet which way the bet is going to be settled. We don't know what the origin of this virus is yet. But when I see the article quoting Anderson, I give it a little bit of the people's eyebrow. That's right, a little bit of the people's eyebrow. So anyway, what else does this article say? Well, one thing it says is that at the heart of the lab origin argument is proximity. It says that, you know, like Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, did you see that? Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, he goes on there and he says, if you go to Hershey, Pennsylvania, and you smell chocolate in the air, it's not because a pangolin mated with a cocoa bean. It's the chocolate factory. That's what it is. So John had a great bit on The Daily Show about that. And so that proximity, that propinquity, as Edna St. Vincent Millay would say, that proximity is at the heart of the lab origin virus, according to the Science Magazine article. I would take a bit of exception with that, too. I think that actually at the heart of the lab origin argument is Occam's razor. Occam's razor, of course, the principle that you don't multiply entities beyond necessity. Often it is sort of simplified as keep it simple, stupid. That's Occam's razor. You don't multiply entities beyond necessity. You don't make them, you don't make things up. Another way to put it is that if you hear hoofbeats, you think horses, you don't think zebras. And that sort of argument works really well in this case for the lab origin hypothesis, because it doesn't require a lot of extra arguments on it. Now, people on the zoonotic side would say that Occam's razor cuts in their direction too. So it's just tough to say. There's not enough evidence here, but I certainly don't think you can reduce the lab leak origin argument to one of simple coincidental geography. So in fact, let's take a minute actually and look at the evidence on either side here, see if we can figure out who's going to win this bet. Well, on the lab origin side, one piece of evidence that's been walked back a bit is the foreign cleavage site. Initially, Nobel laureate David Baltimore, of course, called that a smoking gun for anthropogenic source, for a man-made source. But since then, he said that he wasn't aware of some other bat viruses that did have sort of similar sites. And that piece of evidence no longer generally considered a smoking gun, Although a lot of people still do point to it. Also, you've got the fact that the virus was so well adapted, it immediately jumped up to the pandemic level. It didn't really have to mutate or go through any cycles until it was able to do that. You have the fact that the SARS and the MERS virus viruses, when they came out, their animal hosts were pretty quickly identified in a matter of months, and we're up to a year and a half now with this other, with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. You have the fact that the lab in Wuhan was working under BSL-2 conditions. That's biosafety level 2. That's like my old high school chemistry lab. And believe me, that was not a secure facility. I often had to remind people not to eat the lab, as we always joked about, right? If we're doing some lab with sugar or with salt or something, BSL-2, it's really easy to see how an accident could happen there. And of course, the fact that pandemics have been caused by lab leaks before, right? Like the H1N1 virus escaping a Russian lab in 1977. The fact that SARS itself has escaped labs at least a handful of times. It's broken out of lab before, the first SARS virus. And the fact that, you know, China sure did act guilty. Now, it's probably just a knee-jerk reaction by them or their standard operating procedure, but they did cover up a ton of evidence. They've refused to share evidence. They've obfuscated everything. They have obstructed any investigation. Even the head of WHO came out and spoke against China, which that takes a lot for that to happen. And of course, yeah, the fact that the lab in question was in the right place at the right time, and it just happened to be doing research on viruses exactly like this, and that part of that research involved making these viruses more virulent. So that's, you know, that's a long list. That's a lot more than just propinquity. But on the other side, you know, you have other arguments too. For example, the biggest thing people like Dr. Neil Stuart Neal on Twitter constantly points out is that there's no evidence that this lab or anybody had a necessary ancestor virus or an immediate predecessor virus that, you know, would have allowed for the SARS-CoV-2 virus to develop, whether it was engineered or not. Also, you know, the fact that if Xi Zhengli and these other people here working on this, if they had discovered such a virus, it would have been worth a science paper or a Nature paper. That is a huge deal. That's what these guys live for, short of a Nobel Prize. Science and Nature, the two most prestigious journals in the world, really pretty much regardless of your field of science. And so the argument is that if they had discovered such an important virus, they would have published it, and it would have been a big feather in all their caps. They would not have kept it secret. Another piece of evidence for the zoonotic side is, of course, that now it seems that many Wuhan markets, multiple Wuhan markets, are involved in the initial outbreak. And so maybe the markets weren't the source, but if they weren't the source, if the lab leak argument were true, then why would multiple markets show up in the very first cases? Why wouldn't it be multiple soccer stadiums? Why wouldn't it be multiple gyms? Why wouldn't it be multiple subway trains? Why multiple markets where these live animals were kept? And by the way, you know, Dr. Neil, Stuart Neal, I just mentioned him, virologist from the UK, he has pointed out several times that even if the lab origin is not true, that does not let China off the hook. Even if this has an animal origin, then that still implicates China because of their horrifically lax agricultural, I don't know if agricultural is the right word, but their horrifically lax policies around these live animal markets. China would still be culpable in the case of a natural animal origin because their oversight was absolutely terrible. They've been warned many, 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 many times, according to Dr. Neal, or as Dr. Neal points out. So Those are kind of the two sides and the evidence that we have. Of course, we lost a lot of the early evidence, and China is refusing to release a lot of evidence that would help us decide one way or the other. The report that the U.S. intelligence agencies gave to Biden supposedly had sort of three arms to it, or three pieces, and two of them came down in favor of a natural origin, and one of them came down in favor of a lab origin. So we may never know. We may never get enough evidence to settle this Reese versus Pinker debate, and this bet may just go on into the future. And like the site where it was made, longbets.com, this may be a truly long bet. I would point out that to me, all the evidence in favor of a animal origin. Well, I don't know about all the evidence, but a lot of the evidence that people talk about supporting the zoonotic origin is based on the fact that China's telling us the truth. Now, it's China, it's not Xi Jinping or any of the scientists, because obviously China's in control of what they say. The CCP will not let you speak freely. So, we have to trust that China isn't covering up some ancestor virus. We have to trust that China would have allowed their scientists to publish a big, prestigious paper if they had found such an important virus. We have to trust that China isn't covering up or making up, fabricating evidence that links multiple early Wuhan markets to the virus's first outbreak. We have to trust that all of that is true. And we've seen how well what China has done to deserve our trust, right? With the Uyghurs, we've seen with Heijiankui, we've seen with the CFC, HFC, HCFC output that they keep lying about. We've seen what they've done with trust. So I don't think you can trust the CCP, and that makes me suspicious of the arguments that people are putting out for the animal origin. I'm really not even sure how they can offer these arguments and not suspect China themselves. You have to be really overly trusting, kind of like remember in My Last Duchess, Browning's poem My Last Duchess, he calls his ex-wife. He says she had a heart too soon made glad. And yeah, I think these guys, their hearts are a little too soon made glad by China when they are trusting the CCP on all this. But we don't know, and we can't say. We need to move on. A couple more commentaries, a couple more comments on things going on in the news. There was a coup in Guinea. The military took over, they ousted their former leader, Alpha Conde, and he is out partly because he really was up to some shenanigans running for a third term. So the military took matters into their own hands. They staged a coup. They're in charge now. There's obviously an initial tendency here to say, oh, they're just grabbing power. Of course, this is how all coups go, and now the new military leader will be in charge forever. But guess what? Guess what? Guinea has a history. We're doing a lot of West Africa today here. Guinea actually has a history. In 2008, they had a military coup. The military took over, and then the military got the heck out of the way. And in 2010, there was, by all accounts, a free and open election. That's actually where this guy that they ousted was elected. And then when he overstayed what he was constitutionally really allowed to do, they stepped in, they pulled him out. So there might be a chance that this coup is actually not a power grab, but actually the military doing the right thing. That would be wonderful. So I think we're making a new rule, right? We're making a new rule for coups. It's called the Guinea rule, and here it is. You got 2 years. You got 2 years after a coup, because power transitions take time, right? And they're difficult. 2 years, and then if you've peacefully transferred power to you get the Guinea Award. But if you haven't peacefully transferred power at the end of 2 years, you know what? Then you're just a dictator, and just look up Australia's rule book and follow that. You'll be all set. Good job. By the way, The Economist, right? The Economist magazine, in their chart from October 16th, 2020. They have an amazing, really cool chart that that relates to this Guinea piece. And in this chart, it talks about all the countries in the last century that have had a peaceful transition of power, and it ranks how many peaceful transitions of power these countries have had since World War I. Do you want to guess? Let's set the bar low. Let's set the bar low at one. One peaceful transition of power. Give me a percentage. What percentage of the world's countries have had a peaceful transition of power in the last century since World War I, since the watershed event of the 20th century? It's about 50% have had one. That's not really a high bar, at least you would think. But apparently it is a high bar. Only about half the countries have had even one peaceful transfer of power since World War I. And finally, just note that Guinea is Guinea has the world's largest proven preserves of bauxite. Bauxite, of course, is the ore from which aluminum and gallium are refined. And if you are not aware of how important aluminum and gallium are in various manufacturing processes, then that's unfortunate, because they are very, very important to aluminum for all the obvious reasons, including car frames, right? My F-150 is the last steel frame F-150. Nowadays, I think even the F-150s are aluminum frames. Gallium, of course, used in semiconductors. Gallium is really cool because it has a melting point just above room temperature, and you can melt it in your hand. All right, so yeah, a lot of stuff on West Africa and a lot of stuff on bets here today. So let's go on to our next item here. Our next item is this article in Nature. Well, we just talked about Nature and Science being the most prestigious article. There's an article in Nature from Judah Cohn of MIT, and it's about how we've had a lot of recent freak cold winters, a lot of super severe cold winter weather, and he blames it on, guess what, climate change. That's right, climate change. Used to be called global warming, and he says paradoxically, of course, that climate change could lead to colder winter weather. Well, I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that the climate models do predict that, but I am deeply suspicious of climate models. I think there's no doubt that the temperatures are rising across the globe, but these climate models, they are very suspicious to me. I don't put a lot of faith in them. We'll see. So, you know, if it's going to result in more severe winter weather, I live up here in the mountains. I feel like the ski resorts are going to be like, you know, if this is global warming, give us some more of that. Now, where does climate change rank on your list, by the way, right? How bad is climate change? I feel like a lot of the world's intellectuals are missing an opportunity here to talk about priorities and where climate change ranks in comparison to, say, the pandemic and other things like that. If you take Nordhaus's numbers, right? Nordhaus won, I think, the 2018 economic Nobel. Well, pseudo-Nobel. It is the Nobel Prize for Economics. But so he won this prize with his DICE model. And according to him, simple baseline model, about $22 trillion in 2005 dollars. So I guess that's roughly about $30 trillion in today's dollars. That's the cost of climate change over the next century, global cost. How does that compare to what COVID has done? Well, I will tell you. For example, last October, Geeta Gopinath, the IMF counselor, estimated that the cost of the pandemic was about $28 trillion. $28 trillion lost to the pandemic. Well, that's awfully close to the cost of climate change as estimated by Nordhaus. So, yeah. How do you rank climate change in your list of threats? I don't know. I always say it's not in my top tier. It's up there, but it's definitely not in my top tier. If you're talking about existential threats, right? Threats to the existence of humanity, threats that could cause humanity to go extinct. Well, then, of course, your experts are Nick Bostrom's guys over there at the Future of Humanity Institute in Oxford and Toby Ord. Well, first of all, back in 2008, they didn't include Future Humanity Institute, didn't include climate change at all in their top tier, or even in their report at all, in their initial report. They didn't include it as far as existential threats go. But Toby Ord did publish a paper last year in 2020, good paper. And in his top tier, he has number one existential threat to humanity, unaligned artificial intelligence. Number two, an engineered pandemic. Number three, unforeseen anthropogenic risks. And number four, other anthropogenic risks. That all rounded out his top tier. And then he had a few other things that were listed about 20 to 100 times a next tier down, 20 to 100 times less likely than those things. And climate change and nukes were in that list for him. I would put nukes higher. By the way, it's very noticeable that Toby doesn't have nanotechnology on his list. That was on the list in 2008, or whenever. I could be remembering that year wrong, but roughly around there from Future of Humanity Institute, they were all about nanotechnology, and now it's pretty much disappeared. Although I will say Eric Drexler did just write a paper for FHI last year, so maybe not completely disappeared, but it doesn't. Nanotechnology doesn't seem to be scaring anybody. Nobody seems to be waking up with gray goo fears anymore. If you're wondering about my list, I think my top tier doesn't include for existential risks. Existential risks does not include climate change either. My top tier would be number one is an engineered pandemic or bioterror. Number two is biowarfare. Number three, I have a tie between artificial intelligence, unaligned, and unforeseen anthropogenic risks. And that's a pretty broad category, right? So I'm not sure I would have included it, but I saw Toby did, so I'm like, yeah, I can sign on to that. That's kind of a CYA topic right there. Number five for me is transhumanism. Nobody ever seems to talk about this, but right, that's maybe not a bad way. Maybe it is a bad way, depending on your point of view. But evolving out of our state, humanity could cease to exist because we evolve into something else, better or not. But transhumanism would be my number five. Number six is bio error. And number seven, I would put down nukes and warfare, possibly warfare involving AI, possibly warfare involving unforeseen weapons. But I would put that in my top tier. I would definitely put nuclear warfare, probably combined with some other forms of warfare. I would put that in my top tier for sure. And then dropping down, I would have, climate change in my next tier, 20 to 100 times less likely. I would also have geoengineering accident, right? I hear a lot of people talk about geoengineering. Oh my gosh. That's dangerous stuff right there. That's stuff that I'm not sure that we should be messing with. I would consider also unforeseen solar climate change. There could be stuff going on with our dearest and nearest star that we don't have a full grasp on. We think we have a pretty good grasp on, but I'd have to list it up there. Same sort of odds as some of those other things. Maybe I'd list that half a tier below, and then the last tier down would be like super volcano and maybe even a global carbon inversion bubble. And aliens, right? Aliens probably could be in there. Dark forest theory. Supernova would be even lower than that, probably. Although, like I said, with our solar climate, there could be some unforeseen change there. All right, couple real quick hits here. Bitcoin, 0.5% of global power consumption now. Holy cow. And we try to end the news segment with some good news. So here's some good news. Yesterday, four tuna species were moved up after moved up in terms of their ratings as being endangered or of least concern or threatened or what have you. Their status was improved yesterday by the IUCN, and that's largely due to the fact that we're sort of avoiding the tragedy of the commons, at least avoiding it more than we used to. And we have quotas in place now for fishing, specifically the Atlantic bluefin tuna, moved all the way from endangered to least concern. You go, bluefin tuna. If I ever had a bluefin tuna, I would name it Glen Coco. You go, bluefin tuna. Then the southern bluefin tuna moved from critically endangered to just regular endangered. Albacore and yellowfin tunas from near threatened to least concern. All right, good job there, Albacore. And the Pacific bluefin, there's a lot of bluefin tunas out there. The Pacific bluefin tuna went from vulnerable to near threatened. Near threatened. All right, now we move into our deep dive here, and we're going to continue on our theme from yesterday. We're going to go on to nuclear power to start with and see what is unseen there. Remember, we're talking about this idea from Bastiat that to really understand the world, you have to understand, in some sense, it's opportunity cost, but opportunity costs are just one piece of the picture too. You have to see everything that is unseen. If a kid, remember the parable, if a kid breaks the window, then yes, the money goes to a new window. It's good business for the glassmaker, but as a whole, the world is impoverished because instead of having a working window and whatever that money would have bought, you just have the window, the new window. So let's think about nuclear power, right? We just talked about the fact that Nordhaus's DICE model predicts about $30 trillion current dollar cost to climate change over the next 80 years or so. Well, what about nuclear power? If we use nuclear power, you're cutting down on carbon emissions tremendously. Greta Thunberg could probably articulate this extremely well, but for $30 trillion, you could get a lot of welfare, a lot of good stuff, as George Carlin would say, a lot of stuff. $30 trillion, that's like 150% of our GDP. That's GDP. That's about 200% of China's annual GDP, right? So you could, medicines, you could, you know, have deltas that don't flood. You could have all kinds of discoveries because, for example, our intellectual class maybe wouldn't be tortured by the specter of climate change or haunted by the specter of climate change. They would be free to pursue other results. Instead, we have eschewed nuclear power. We've turned away from nuclear power and we are using still power sources that do contribute gases that are going to heat up our planet. And we are using power sources that are probably extremely cost inefficient. The cost of photovoltaic cells is coming way, 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 way down, which is great. But wind power, if you saw Planet of the Humans with Michael Moore, those wind mills, they only last for a decade, couple decades, three decades, and then they're junk. It's not especially sustainable, and that's a bad thing in a technology that is vaunted for being sustainable. So nuclear power is really a huge missed opportunity here, right? Because it would cut down on carbon emissions. And that's the first thing today. And what is unseen is if we were using nuclear power, what would we have? What could we spend that $30 trillion on? I don't know. A lot of good stuff. Second, let's begin our deep dive here. This will stretch into tomorrow because we're running short on time today already. But we have the FDA and the regulatory burden. So many people do not understand what we are missing. They do not see what could be if only we didn't have the FDA and other regulatory agencies constantly standing in our way, right? Over at marginalrevolution.com, Tyler Cowan and Alex Tabarrok are constantly posting things. Our regulatory state is failing us. Yeah. Yeah. That one gets two thumbs up. I think it's obvious to anyone who's being intellectually honest That's a bit of a banal, trite phrase. Sorry about that. But I think it's clear that our regulatory state is failing us. Scott Alexander published an amazing essay just about a month ago, Adumbrations of Adjunicanab. I don't know if I pronounced that right. I'm sorry. That Alzheimer's medicine. And he took down the FDA. He absolutely destroyed the FDA. And talked about how it's costing us some lives. Let me give you a few other things, though, that aren't in that Scott Alexander piece. So, sunscreen. The Food and Drug Administration here in the United States has not approved any new sunscreen since the 1990s. Since the 1990s. Can you imagine if your, say, video game technology had not improved since the 1990s? If you weren't allowed to have any new video games since the 1990s? What about your cars? How about the safety technology in your cars? If that hadn't improved since the 1990s, how about your phone? If your phone hadn't improved since the 1990s? Yeah, well, our FDA hasn't approved any sunscreen products since the 1990s. And it's not for a lack of sunscreen products. They are out there. Other markets around the world have improved them, have approved them. We have not. Now, roughly in the United States, about 10,000 deaths per year from skin cancer. New sunscreens. I don't know. Let's say 1%. 1% might save that. Maybe not even just because the sunscreens are all that more effective, but maybe they're more convenient, right? My kids hate putting on sunscreen. They will twist. They'll take skin cancer to get out of putting on sunscreen as far as they're concerned. So maybe the new sunscreens would be so much easier to get on. Maybe, you know, through that avenue, they would be more effective. And let's say 1% of skin cancers are avoided. I mean, you know, 1% over the last 20 years, you're talking a couple thousand people. So that's, you know, that's significant. That's a couple thousand lives set. Here's another example that saved. Another example, not in the Scott Alexander piece. You've got this blood pressure drug, nitroprusside. Again, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. You know, I just read these things. I don't have a cool college faculty I can sit down with at lunch and discuss things, these things with over the table. So nitroprusside, there's two generic versions about to enter the market finally now. And the brand names are Nitropress and Nipride, and they were going for about $900. And now that there are generic versions about to enter the market, the price is down to $200. Oh my gosh, that, you know, if the FDA had approved these other drugs earlier, then we could have been saving, however, you know, $600, $700 per dose of this drug. That would go a long way towards that which is unseen. We would have better health, and we would still have $700 to spend on maybe Jimmy Buffett concert tickets. Maybe you could go see a Shakespeare play so that you understand what I was talking about yesterday with Ben Kingsley in Shang-Chi. There's a lot of stuff you could do with $700 extra in your pocket. I'll just point out a couple other examples. One from the Scott Alexander article that everybody talks about a lot is AIDS drugs, right? If the FDA had just been a couple years faster, and a couple years is nothing to the FDA, if they had just been a couple years faster approving the AIDS drugs, they would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Hundreds of thousands of lives lost because they were too dilatory. They took too long. Most recent example, one of the most egregious examples, Helen Chu out in the Pacific Northwest. Helen Chu had an amazing testing regime set up. She was one of the first people in the United States to discover that COVID had arrived in the United States. She tested for it. She wanted to continue testing for it. She let the FDA know what was going on. And what happened? Yeah, of course, they shut her down. She was approved to give tests, but she wasn't approved to give coronavirus tests. How could she be since it didn't exist before? I don't know. I don't know how she possibly could have been, but since she wasn't approved for that, she wasn't allowed to continue testing. And so then for, you know, weeks longer or months, critical time at the beginning of the pandemic, we had no idea how the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes the COVID disease, how that was spreading in the United States. Just absolutely terrible job by the FDA there. We'll get into more of their malfeasance tomorrow. You know, these have real costs. These are, we're talking, you know, more lives saved. We're talking about better quality of life while you're living, more years with your dad, more years with your grandfather, more years with your son, another Christmas, another chance to lose to Ohio State next year. It always happens to us poor Wolverine fans. Anyway, that is going to be the end of our deep dive for today. And, you know, we talked about the Pinker and Reese debate. We talked about the how it rests upon the origin of the virus, the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Is it a lab origin? Is it not a lab origin, but a natural origin? Then we talked about the coup in Guinea, the global warming article in Nature, very interesting, and existential threats to humanity. We had some good news with the tuna. Yay, tuna. And of course, we started talking about what was unseen. So that's what we covered today. And tomorrow, we will be back at it with more commentary on the news and also a further deep dive into some new topics. We'll touch on the FDA again and also get into some new topics. What is unseen? What you are missing that you might not be aware of? Take care, everybody.